Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 11th, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is TXA for Subarachnoid Hemorrhage. Won't stop me now. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Robert Edmonds. He is an emergency physician in the U.S. Air Force in Ohio. This is Bob's 12th visit to the SGEM, but we can't start without a disclaimer from the United States government. Go ahead, Bob.
So to be clear, this is not from the U.S. government. The disclaimer is the views and opinions of this podcast do not represent the United States government or the U.S. Air Force.
All right, now we can get into the show. And it is so hard to believe that this is your 12th visit to the SGEM as a guest skeptic.
Yeah, I still can't believe you keep letting me back on.
It's because you do a great job. But when we started, I think you were a captain, but now you're a major.
Yep. I got a little promotion and I've got a new job out here in Ohio teaching a pre-deployment course for a ground surgical team. It's interesting because Air Force obviously usually does stuff in the air, but this is kind of more of an Army style gig, but it's great.
Well, we have some grand rounds coming up this spring that we're going to do together. Can you tell the SGEMers a little bit about what we're planning?
Yeah, so we're going to do a live podcast back at my old residency, socially distanced by several hundred miles, though, from my house. I'm at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, for a joint trauma conference with trauma as well as the ER docs.
Well, we had been trying to arrange something for in-person for a couple of years now, but then, of course, this COVID thing got in the way. So I'm glad we're finally going to be able to, even though we're going to have to physically distance, but stay socially connected and do some virtual rounds.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Well, you brought us a case, so let's get on with the case for today's episode.
Yeah, so you're working a busy evening shift in your community ED when a 58-year-old female presents with rapid onset, terrible intensity headache. She has no significant prior headache history, and you're concerned for subarachnoid hemorrhage. So you order a head CT, which confirms your suspicions. You page neurosurgery at the bigger ED in town. While you wait for the page back, you wonder if giving TXA could help improve the patient's chances for a good outcome, given its effect in other bleeding processes.
Well, the case you just presented brings up a number of issues that we should probably review here in the background information. And one of the issues is the use of a clinical decision instrument to decide about obtaining a CT scan in the first place to rule out a subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Yeah, so in the case presented, the woman would qualify using the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule because of the rapid onset of an intense headache as well as age. I don't usually use this. For me, it's more of a general feeling of how the patient looks.
And that's an important point. I don't sort of formally use the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. I also use clinical gestalt, but people need to remember, how do clinical decision instruments get created? Well, it comes from a derivation of what do you think would be strongly associated in clinically predicting what this person has. And so what you're trying to do is you take this huge derivation set of variables and try to find the ones that are most closely tied to the outcome of interest. And it's sort of crowdsourcing clinical experience. And then you put that into validation and say, hey, does it actually work? So if you have good clinical gestalt, that's what the clinical decision instrument is used for. So I tend to use these clinical decision instruments for teaching purposes. Do you also use this to teach new clinicians?
Not this one in specific, but some of the other rules specifically out of the Ottawa group, more just for kind of who is at higher risk for an injury so they can start developing the gestalt. But I think that if you have enough concern, you're going to override these instruments, rules, whatever you want to call them, every single time.
Yeah, no. And again, they're not so much rules. They're instruments and they should guide our care and inform our care, but they shouldn't dictate our care. And most of them, if not all of them, I think, have some kind of disclaimer that, you know, it shouldn't trump your clinical judgment. If you're concerned, you're concerned. but we've discussed the incredible work done by Dr. Jeff Perry and his group in the development of these Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rules. And in fact, Jeff was on the SGEM as a guest skeptic discussing this very clinical decision instrument way back in 2013 on SGEM number 48.
Well, that certainly is a while ago. So if you're going to use it, it's to be applied to alert patients older than 15 years of age with new, severe, non-traumatic headache reaching max intensity within an hour.
Yeah, it's not meant for patients with new neurologic deficits or a previous aneurysm, or if the patient has a brain tumor, or who have a history of recurrent headaches. And they actually define what recurrent headaches mean in the clinical decision instrument. And they say, listen, if a patient's having at least three or more episodes of headaches over the course of at least 6 months, this rule does not apply.
Then they go on to say you should investigate, which for me is going to mean CT, if you have at least one of the following high-risk variables: age 40 or older, neck pain or stiffness, witness loss of consciousness, an onset during exertion, thunderclap headache, which is basically instantly peaking pain. I always say it's like turning a light switch on, or limited neck flexion on examination.
Our SGEM bottom line 8 years ago was that the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool was not ready for prime time to rule out low-risk patients from investigations.
Fast forward to 2018 and the validation of the same rule. The results of this prospective observational study was that the clinical decision instrument was 100% sensitive, didn't miss a single patient, and 13.6% specific.
The guest skeptic for that episode, which was number 201, was Dr. Chris Carpenter, who literally wrote the book on diagnostic accuracy of clinical decision instruments in the emergency department with his colleague, Dr. Jesse Pines. The SGEM bottom line from that episode was that the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule needs external validation, a meaningful impact analysis performed, and patient acceptability of incorporating this rule into a shared decision-making instrument before being widely adopted.
Dr. Perry did publish a prospective implementation of the rule in Stroke 2019. This separate article was covered on SGEM with EM nerd Dr. Rory Spiegel, demonstrated the rule is highly sensitive, again, 100%, but again demonstrated very poor specificity of 13%. It's unclear how it performs against unstructured clinical judgment or in non-urban tertiary care teaching hospitals.
Another issue that this case brings up is whether a CT scan is good enough to rule out a subarachnoid hemorrhage. There's been a historic debate around this, about whether or not you need to also get a lumbar puncture, an LP, on these patients after obtaining a non-con or non-contrast CT head.
So again, it leads back to more work done by Dr. Perry. His team published a prospective cohort study that suggested if you got the CT scan done within 6 hours of headache onset, if it's a third-generation CT scanner, and it's read by a neuroradiologist, you do not need to get an LP to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage.
And there were some limitations to this observational study. And another study that was done in the UK tried to address this issue of, do you need an LP post-normal non-con CT head? And this was covered in SGEM 134. And it found that the NN tap, or that's number needed to tap to diagnose one aneurysm that wasn't identified by a CT scan, was 250.
The final issue the case identifies is the use of TXA in treating patients with a subarachnoid hemorrhage. We're skeptical given the previous review we did on this topic in SGEM 236. It was a structured critical review of the 2018 TITCH trial in Lancet. The primary outcome showed no superiority of TXA compared to placebo for the modified Rankin scale at 90 days. The SGEM bottom line was that TXA does not currently have evidence of improving outcomes in hemorrhagic stroke, and routine administration cannot be recommended at this time.
However, Bob, as good, healthy skeptics, our positions are tentative, and we will change our positions when presented with convincing evidence. Just because TXA was not demonstrated to, quote, work in one randomized control trial does not mean we can claim that TXA does not work The burden of proof is on those making a claim of efficacy, and patients deserve the best care based on the best evidence.
That's right. So TXA keeps coming up on the S-gen for numerous different conditions, including trauma, isolated traumatic brain injury, GI bleeding, postpartum hemorrhage, and epistaxis. Although some EM docs would like to believe TXA is one of the universal duct tapes of the ED, it has demonstrated some mixed results.
And patients suffering from an aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage are at risk of rebleeding, which could worsen their long-term clinical outcome and chance of death. A hypothesis raised in the previous Sprigg et al. Randomized control trial was perhaps by treating these people really early or ultra quickly with TXA, they would have a better patient-oriented outcome. All right, well, that's enough background material. Let's get into the actual clinical question we're trying to solve. What is it?
Does rapid administration of tranexamic acid in patients with CT-confirmed subarachnoid hemorrhage improve clinical outcome?
And the reference?
Post et al. Ultra-early tranexamic acid after subarachnoid hemorrhage, a randomized controlled trial in Lancet 2021.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Adults 18 years and older with signs and symptoms for less than 24 hours, indicating a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and who have a non-contrast CT confirming subarachnoid hemorrhage.
And there's a number of exclusions, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
TXA 1 gram IV bolus as soon as possible after a non-con CT proven diagnosis of subarachnoid hemorrhage, followed by a 1 gram infusion over 8 hours, repeated for up to 24 hours for 4 grams total, or until endovascular or surgical treatment, whichever came first.
And what did they compare it to?
Usual care.
And let's run through the outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
Primary outcome was neurologic outcome, dichotomized to good with a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 3, or poor with a modified Rankin scale of 4 to 6 at 6 month follow-up.
And then they had some secondary outcomes?
Yep. So they chose excellent being defined as an outcome with a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 2. They looked at ordinal shift of the modified Rankin scale, as well as all-cause mortality at 30 days, as well as 6 months, and any serious adverse events.
The author's conclusions were, quote, in patients with CT-proven subarachnoid hemorrhage, presumably caused by a ruptured aneurysm, ultra-early, short-term tranexamic acid treatment did not improve clinical outcome at 6 months as measured by the modified Rankin scale. Well, this is your 12th visit to the SGEM, so you know that we have 11 quality checklist questions for randomized clinical trials. So let's run through those. Are these ED patients?
So it's not explicitly stated. This was based in the Netherlands. They do have a number of emergency departments, but there's no way of telling if these were patients that presented primarily to an ED.
Did they adequately randomize the patients?
Yes, they used a one-to-one secured web-based permuted block system.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes.
And did they analyze patients into the groups that they were randomized?
Yes.
Were patients selected consecutively?
This is, again, not explicitly stated.
When you compare groups at baseline, those in the intervention group with the TXA and those in the usual care, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
They were.
Was everybody blinded in this study?
No. So patients, investigators, and healthcare providers were not masked. The research nurses who performed outcome assessment for follow-up, they were masked.
Was everyone treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
Did they have complete follow-up?
They did.
Do you think they considered all patient important outcomes?
I think so.
And the 11th question, the final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
It was a negative result, but I do think the answer is yes.
All right, let's run through the key results. The cohort consisted of just about 1,000 patients with a mean age of 58 years, and two-thirds were female. The median time from ictus, so that's when they had signs and symptoms of onset of the subarachnoid hemorrhage, to actually getting the CT scan was 93 minutes. And then the median time from the signs and symptoms suggestive of subarachnoid hemorrhage to actually receiving TXA was double that time. It was 185 minutes, or about 3 hours. So, Bob, give us the key result.
So the key result was there was no result. There was no difference in giving TXA ultra early versus usual care.
Yeah, and to remind the SJMers, their primary outcome was good clinical outcome, and they define that as a modified Rankin scale score of 0 to 3. So what were the actual numbers that weren't statistically different?
So in the TXA group, they found 60% of patients had a good clinical outcome and 64% in the control, which had an odds ratio of 0.86. Their confidence intervals did cross over 1. So again, not statistically significant.
And the point estimate showed that patients getting TXA actually had a lower percentage of having a good clinical outcome compared to control or usual care, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't in the direction of favoring TXA. How about the secondary outcomes?
So again, this did not favor giving TXA ultra early. 48% of the TXA group had an excellent clinical outcome, but 56% in the control group with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.73, which was clinically significant and statistically significant.
And then they did look at an ordinal shift of the modified Rankin scale, and there was no statistical difference observed.
They looked at all-cause mortality at 30 days as well as 6 months, and it was the same, no difference.
And then finally, adverse events, and they didn't report any statistical difference between the groups with regards to adverse events. All right, those are the key results. Now let's talk a little nerdy, Bob. You ready to go?
Absolutely, always. So number one, this was open label. Patients, investigators, and clinicians treating the patient were all aware of the patient's inclusion in the treatment arm of the trial. This opens the study to significant biases. It's unknown why the authors elected to pursue an open label study instead of providing the control group with a placebo, as this would have reduced the chance for bias significantly.
And I understand that having a lack of blinding in this case could have introduced bias, but I suspect that the bias would have been in favor of finding a better outcome with TXA. The fact that it was unblinded actually strengthens my confidence in the results they found. How do you feel about that?
I'm uncertain. I feel like it would have been cleaner had they had a placebo group, because it's not known to me what the Netherlands thinks about TXA. If they're biased to think that it's likely to harm their patient, then that could have influenced the study as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, fair enough. Because I guess my bias was, in Europe, there seems to be a greater acceptance of TXA for various treatments. At least that was demonstrated in the CRASH 3 trial. And in the U.S., there's a little bit more reluctance to accept the data. And so I was going with the bias, could have pushed the direction towards favoring TXA. But you bring up a good point. That's just one of my own biases. I don't know specifically what people think in the Netherlands. And perhaps some listeners could respond and let us know. Point number two is about patient selection. It was not stated in the methods section that these were ED patients, but it's likely that they were coming from the emergency department. They also did not explicitly say the patients were recruited consecutively, 24, 7, 365. Now, 20 patients allocated to the TXA group did not receive treatment, with 9 out of those 20 for what was listed as unknown reasons. Patients were also excluded on the subjective assessment that death was imminent within 24 hours. I'm not a great predictor of the future. I'm a pretty good predictor of the past, but I find it always a little risky. I don't know if you've had that same experience, Bob, where you go, geez, I really don't think this person's going to survive. And you may come back to your next shift and find out that they actually did. And other times you go, oh, yeah, no, I'm not concerned. And you may mention to the family that, I'll say my spidey senses aren't tingling or something like that. And then you come back to the next shift and, oh, they did pass away. So I find it very, very challenging to decide subjectively on whether death was imminent within 24 hours. Anyways, these factors could have introduced some selection bias into the cohort of included patients.
Point number three is subgroup analysis. The authors state that their findings show routine use of TXA and spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage cannot be recommended. However, the fact that their secondary outcome of excellent clinical outcome was worse in the TXA group by a statistically significant amount is concerning.
Yeah, but we need to be careful not to overinterpret subgroup analyses. They should generally be considered hypothesis generating. However, if the subgroup had shown a benefit of TXA, I wonder if there would be a press release, a beautiful infographic, and an appeal from authorities to implement a protocol based on a subgroup.
Well, I think we can be cautious with analyzing subgroups, but this was a planned subgroup that they were looking at when the study was first designed. So I think it is some sort of signal.
All right. Well, the fourth thing we wanted to talk about was adverse events. And it is reassuring that they did not identify a statistical increase in adverse events. There was a 4% absolute, or 50% relative, increase in seizures reported in the TXA group compared to the standard group. This was most likely a spurious finding and represents noise in the data. The odds ratio was 1.5, but when you looked at the 95% confidence interval, it did start at 1.0. And this was only mentioned in the table of the results section. We wonder if this finding was reversed and TXA appeared to be protective against seizures, would it have been highlighted perhaps in the abstract?
I guess we'll never know. Point five, external validity. So this was a large, multi-centered RCT performed in the Netherlands. Median time from onset of stroke signs and symptoms to CT scan was 93 minutes.
Oh, there are many sites in Canada, and probably some in the US, that this would not be possible to get a CT scan within 90 minutes due to either a lack of a CT scanner or just the sheer geography of our countries.
I can think of several places. The median time to aneurysm treatment was 14 hours after symptom onset. The authors posit in a prior trial by Hillman looking at short-term TXA use for subarachnoid hemorrhage, the rate of rebleeds was lower than in their study. And the Hillman study, the first hospital contact was more than 4 hours after symptom onset.
Well, taking this information together, it challenges the generalizability of this study as other hospital systems in more rural and, in particular, remote settings may have more substantial delays in patient presentation and time to aneurysmal treatment.
So it remains unknown if in these other systems what role TXA might play, as it's possible much of the benefit in rebleeding reduction isn't seen when the aneurysm is treated in a timely manner.
All right, that's enough nerdiness. Now let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
Well, that's straightforward. We generally agree.
Well, can you give us a straightforward bottom line then?
TXA use in subarachnoid hemorrhage does not presently have sufficient evidence to recommend its routine use.
And how about a case resolution?
So you talk in neurosurgery, they recommend nimodipine, which you start, you monitor the patient's blood pressure closely, they accept the patient, and you transfer him downtown.
All right, so how are you going to take this new study and apply it clinically?
So for me, there's really no change in my current practice, but I think it's always helpful to know the limitations to the uses of TXA and any other medication to avoid falling for indication creep.
And what are you going to tell this 58-year-old patient at the bedside?
So, ma'am, I'm real glad you came into the ED. Your headache's from a scary cause, but we're going to take care of it. It's from something called an aneurysm, and we believe that aneurysm is now bleeding in your brain, which is very painful. It can be treated. I already spoke to the brain surgeons, and we're going to transfer you to their hospital. She's maybe going to recommend surgery to fix the problem, but in the meantime, we're going to treat your pain and watch your blood pressure like a hawk. The ambulance will be here pretty soon to transfer you to the bigger hospital, but we'll be taking care of you in the meantime.
It's time to announce the Keener Contest winner, and last week's winner was Sebastian Nemitz. He knew that Kesselbeck's plexus is the most common area
for nosebleeds. What's the Keener contest question this week, Bob?
What percentage of Americans have a brain aneurysm at some point in their lifetime?
So we're looking for an approximate answer. And if you know the approximate percentage of Americans that have a brain aneurysm at some point in their lifetime, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, thanks, Bob, for coming back on the SGEM. We'll have to plan something special for, do you guys have the term in the US, a baker's dozen, where it's 13?
Yeah, I actually used to work in a bagel shop that my dad owned and operated, and people would sometimes get confused why there was an extra bagel in their bag.
Yeah, so it is something there. So cool that you used to work in a bakery of some kind. Yeah, so we'll have a baker's dozen episode next time because you are coming back.
Absolutely.
Well, there is CME available for this episode, and actually now for all SGEM episodes. The content is always free, but there's a small fee for the CME. And what we're trying to do is keep this free open access platform going. And we came up with this way to do it by saying, listen, we'll keep producing this content. You can still access this content. We want patients to get the best care based on the best evidence. We want to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year. But if you want to get credit for something that you're already doing and listening to the SGEM, we've arranged that for you. And then there is this small fee, and that will help support the SGEM and keep it sustainable. Well, Bob, I'm looking forward to our next episode, but until then, can you read the SGEM tagline?
Absolutely. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it from the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.